You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Bill Feeman. He's an artist, scholar, has produced major installations all over the world. He's also a professor in art, art history, and visual studies at Duke University, where he's exploring ideas like recombinant poetics and neosentience research. Bill, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hey, it's nice to be here. Thanks for including me.
Let's jump into
recombinant,
if that's okay. We can
But
let's jump into recombinant poetics. What does that mean? How did you come to define that?
Interestingly, it goes way back, all the way to when I was doing a master's degree at MIT. We began to explore, this was around 1983, we began to explore interactive video. It was really new at that time. People hadn't worked with it. And out of that, I got very interested in how you could combine and recombine images and music and text in different ways. And that became a whole series of interactive works. And so the notion of recombinance comes from DNA, so it's kind of this metaphor of recombinance, almost like the media is alive.
So that's fascinating. And how did that manifest in early works years?
The first one was an installation. There are different kinds of states of the media. So there was a CD-ROM that was made. Imagine a kind of sentence generator with 10 separate little linguistic parts. And then imagine you have, let's say, 33 variables that you can keep substituting into those parts of the sentence. But then also imagine that there's a piece of music that's attached to that sentence, as well as an image for each of those different 33 sections. So I made this interactive interface that would let you very easily substitute different words into the sentence. So you could make, a huge number of combinations of these audiovisual sentences, or you could hit random and it would make a random kind of sentence. And so it's the kind of thing where you could actually never, if you spent your whole life, you wouldn't see all the combinations that would come up in the piece. So it was done that way, but it was also done as an installation in a room. And then in the Sydney Biennial, the sentence, the 10 words of the sentence would play out across 10 screens. So you would see one screen, and then it would go still, and the second screen, and it would still with the image, and so on, just playing through these 33 sentences. And along with that was a CD that was released. So lots of times I have these, different states of media.
So let me ask perhaps a basic question, but about how all that was put together. So looking at those screens and seeing all that happen, is this then, in a sense, how I'm reading it, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but almost as an illustration of the kind of narrative complexities of how the genome and DNA are actually working, the kind of instructions.
In a way, it's like that, but in a way, it's more pointing at meaning. I talk about this idea of meta-meaning. So as you're using this thing, as you play with it, you can watch the meaning arise and change, and you can put things in new contexts. So for those Wittgenstein fans out there, this idea is the meaning is the use. As you use this in different places, it takes on different meanings. But then it's also more complex because you have a whole module, what I call fields of meaning, of an image has a kind of field of meaning, the text has a field of meaning, and the music has a field of meaning, and they all kind of act upon each other to create this sort of felt meaning that you, the viewer or user of the system, explores.
But and isn't there also the field of it being, of how it's actually generated? There's a type of, if you will, randomness to what's happening?
Well, you can hit random, so it is a randomness. But it's a kind of control. I've loaded the dice in a way because I loaded the database with the kinds of images and the kinds of texts and the music and so on. So, for example, I like word plays, so I would use different puns, knowing that as they would fall in different places in the text, new meanings would kind of come out, or the meaning would shift.
Right.
So after that one, that was very, you know, sentence-like, but I got more interested in, could I make something more haiku-like or more open in its structure, not super, but, you know, not the numerical system, but more, more like a poem. And I did a piece called One Pulls Pivots at the Tip of the Tongue. And this was a very big piece. It had 150 images that made up a kind of distributed poem. If you know Mallarmé's A Throw of the Dice Will Not Annul Chance, that's an early poem that has words kind of distributed over the page. And you could navigate over the surface of these 150 images, or you could click on a word that would take you to another kind of little poem generator instead of a sentence. It would create a new poem as you would scroll through things, or again, you could hit random. But then there was a video segment tied to each of these 150 images, and you could, if you clicked on the play, it would then trigger that. And that particular piece went all over. It was in New York, and won a prize at Ars Electronica, and was purchased is in a couple of collections, museum collections in Germany.
Well, does it also enter into the realm of, if it's not too dated now, is kind of game theory and how we are interacting and making choices with electronics? Isn't that also part of?
Yeah, well, game, it is like a game, to an extent. It is like play, to an extent. It's interactive, but it's different than the kind of games that have very, you know, fixed goals. It's very much designed for you to navigate and move through it and find things. And you know, most people spend about, you know, a very short period of time with a work of art. But with these works, you really go into it, and in fact, you can keep returning to it and navigate through it and find new things.
So let's talk about that structure a little bit of returning,
sure,
and navigating through it.
Yeah.
That, to me, sounds like something I wanted to kind of clear up in my own head about narrative and non-narrative storytelling or interaction. Isn't there, this isn't narrative, correct?
Yeah, well, it's a kind of non-narrative poetics. It's a kind of navigational poem that you move through in different ways. And so you create a narrative in your mind, in a sense, but it's presented in a non-narrative, non-linear manner.
Because you have so many choices.
Exactly. I mean, there's so many choices. Almost no two people look at it in the same way or navigate it in the same way. At the same time, it's a fixed amount of material, and again, I've loaded the dice by shooting the video very carefully. But in this case, I can tell you that I was thinking a lot about the internet and this and long distance relationships, and so part of the video was shot in Tokyo, and part was shot in Germany, and it's kind of in a very abstract way about this relationship between these two people.
Well, then, in a way, it is a type of, thinking of it that way, as having this storyline almost, isn't it a type of cinema, of storytelling, of interactive cinema almost?
Yeah, it's interactive cinema, exactly. It's a kind of interactive storytelling, but I don't write it in a traditional narrative. You know, I'm more interested in the sound of the words and poetic phrases that come out of it. I mean, even like when I say one pulls pivots at the tip of the tongue, you already get the idea, well, maybe it's a bit about memory, or maybe it's about shifting things, or, you know, so again, this sort of meta level of talking about things.
But that's also a puzzle level in a sense.
Yeah, it's a bit like a puzzle. It's a bit, when I make it, it's a bit like a taking a puzzle and making it in reverse or something. It's you experience it, and you take away your own feelings and thoughts and associations. And it's really like this associative network that I create that you move through, and the fact that you make the choices, you're invested in it a little bit differently than you would just reading something or just listening to something.
Right. I of course come from the arts and see it in the context of other artworks, but I'm also seeing and listening to what you're saying in the context of games that I see. I have a 14-year-old son. He's playing games that are, they're very sophisticated, what kind of the genre of artists are doing out there in, making kind of small games. And they tend to be these, obviously much more straightforward than
narrative,
but they are telling these stories that you can kind of move in any direction of. They end up the same, or sometimes they have multiple endings. But kind of really explore in ways that are getting pretty abstract and sophisticated. It's
already the next step in this kind of recombinant poetics was me beginning to build virtual worlds. It was kind of like, if I could build a sentence, why couldn't I build a sentence that's made of code that would do something? So I worked with a programmer named Gideon May, and we made a piece called The World Generator, The Engine of Desire. And the idea was, imagine at the time, this is like 92, it was not so easy to build a virtual world, or more or less what a game world looks like now. And so I thought, how could I possibly make an interface that would be so easy that anybody could use it? So we kind of used a Rolodex-like system. But imagine you had containers that had 3D objects and had images and had movies and had sounds and had text. And in real time, you could spin it and select something, and it would put it into the world. And so you could literally in real time build this world. Or you could hit a random all, and it would put like 50 objects and 50 sounds and 50 and something I call re-embodied intelligence. So if you think of an artist has a sensibility, this machine, when you would hit this random, would actually build quite a beautiful world that you could then navigate through. Now lots of kids' games have this thing where you can build things and move through it and play with it. But at that time, it was a very early, people weren't making these kind of generative systems. There's this new, at Duke, there's a new Media Arts and Sciences, and I have a lab called the Emergence Lab that I co-run with John Supko from the music department. And we explore emergence in image, emergence in sound and music, and emergence in text. So it kind of takes these ideas, these recombinant ideas, and we do a whole class surrounding them. And this lab is designed for doing that kind of work.
And how does that interact with the neo-sentience research? Is that separate? Or?
No, it's kind of the pragmatic step toward it. So John Supko and I, the person from music, he's a very talented musician, but he also writes computer code. And so we worked and made a kind of intelligent music engine that would help us generate music. It was a kind of remix engine, but then it also was a kind of AI. So it was the two of us kind of collaborating with that system. And neosentience research, just so people know, is... And in fact, there's a book that you can get on Amazon. It was research done with Otto Rossler, who's most famous for the Rossler attractor and chaos theory. And for a very long time, for 10 years, we discussed all different aspects of artificial intelligence and the future of robotics. And we were very interested in the history and who plays into this and where are these ideas coming from. And we ended up writing a book that has like 300 little micro chapters about all of these different people, and we got very interested in the idea, this is where the recombinant informatics comes in, that you could kind of take any two of these little chapters talking about AI and it would suggest a new research area that you might undertake. And so the main idea is, if have you ever heard of the Turing test before for artificial intelligence? Or
Sure, but let's talk about it, yeah.
Well, but what we did is instead of this famous Turing test where you kind of fool somebody into wondering whether it's a person or not, in this case we had these very pragmatic kind of goals that the system would have, that it would use natural language, that it would use multimodal sensing to build up knowledge of environments, that it would be creative to some degree, which is a very interesting problem, that it would be mirror competent. Certain animals that kind of have an awareness of themselves, that's this mirror competence, that it would, we would create synthetic emotions for the system, and that it would be benevolent in nature. There's a lot of research going into kind of destructive robots, and we're interested in this kind of future of benevolent robots. That's a pretty quick summing up of the what neosentience is, but...
Okay, so I love that, and thank you for that summing up. If neosentience, as your practice evolves and what you're doing now with recombinant poetics and mm-hmm. neosentience, what do you imagine is kind of an outcome, or what is a further exploration of this in the future? I'm just trying to future of where this is all pointing to, and I know it's a whole variety of unknowns, but.
A guy named Roger Molina, who's the editor of Leonardo magazine, kind of said, "Bill, what's the next step?" Just like you're doing, and what I ended up doing was kind of out of the history of recombinant poetics, I made a new kind of system that I call the Insight Engine, and the Insight Engine. The idea is that in this new kind of research, it's really a kind of transdisciplinary research where you have to bring people together from very different kinds of backgrounds, and they have to be able to talk about things. And as you probably know, in publishing, when you publish, you tend to be within a certain group of publications, and there's a certain kind of language and so on. But if you're doing transdisciplinary research, somebody might be doing something in a completely different area. So the idea is I would invite these different researchers from all different areas. And, so there's computer scientists and there are biologists and people that are studying brain science and so on. And the idea of the system is you would see a kind of, you could click on them and you would see a kind of world of all their papers, and you could kind of spin that around and look at it. If you clicked on the title, it would actually, the paper would be called up, or a video would be called up, or a URL, and you could close that. So you could kind of decide right away, do I like this guy? Is this an interesting idea? And then let's say I call up a totally different researcher or a historical person like a cyberneticist, Gordon Pask, and I can click on any two papers, and then what happens is you do a query, and it goes into all of the papers that are in the database system, and it does a statistical analysis and a semantic analysis and pulls the relevant papers from those two things. So it's kind of this transdisciplinary search engine that's very playful. And then another part of it is, in other words, it's kind of facilitating people bridging ideas across different fields that could lend toward chipping away at this very difficult pragmatic set of things that I mentioned earlier. And right. And one other menu takes all of the keywords from the papers and makes a kind of sentence going all the way back to the very first work I described. In this case, it makes a kind of scientific sentence that's always correct linguistically but generates new ideas because you can pull from keywords from all different fields that come together in the sentence. So that's my the kind of research wing of what I've been working on. And it turns out that a lot of people are interested in how it's working and want to use it or apply it to other areas other than, you know, neosentient research.
Okay, so so that's a good way to kind of close this, even though this is somewhat of a big issue. So you're an artist, and you're working in a scientific and academic realm. Mm-hmm. I would think that some of the things you're talking about have commercial applications. There's beyond the art world and how things were bought and sold. There's also, as you just kind of hinted at, other people taking an interest in some of these ideas. I would think it's for patent and production possibilities. Is that an issue that you deal with, run into, pursue, or not?
Well, it's an interesting question. And in this case, we used all open source software for it. So there's some potential for licensing aspects of it. But I'm one of these people that has more fun continuing working on things than going out and trying to be commercial. So so far, there's no big, giant commercial successes. But you never know what might happen in the future.
Thanks so much for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure talking to you.
Okay, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.